Hello, everybody. Good morning. This is Ian Williams from the Foreign Press Association, and we are returning with heavy heart to Gaza and the United Nations. And today we have Craig McIver. Is that the right pronunciation, Craig?
Right, as good as any, Ian.
Okay. So no one knows where this Arabic Scots McIver of that ilk. So Craig was the director of the Human Rights Commission New York office until he joined, I hate to claim he was unique, but he is unique, but it was a long list of people who have resigned, been pushed out, retired, and there's a certain sameness about it. It is almost invariably the same issue on the Middle East. You have to remember the distinguished predecessors here. We have a former president of Ireland, Mary Robinson, who was squeezed out because she did not pursue a sort of a party line on the Middle East. And it's a very fine line because somehow the people in the Human Rights Office have to reconcile the actual very clear and explicit writing of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and the various resolutions and instruments, and at the same time, pander to those who want to see them ignored in one particular case, but also in the case of the United States quite often. But usually it's the United States as a proxy for Israel. So Gaza brings this into really stark relief because in the face of the world deciding that what is happening in Gaza is insupportable, we find a barrage of criticism of Antonio Guterres, who I think surprised everybody by exercising his powers under Article 99 to insist it be put on the agenda. And this comes to one of the points. How can you have human rights declaration that some of the worst offenders can veto? And I don't think there's any of the permanent five or in any way got clean hands on this. The British have defied over South Africa, over Rhodesia, over Chagos, and the Diego Garcia. The Chinese just defied it whenever possible, claiming they were in complete coherence. We have Putin, who's actually invoking it for the 75th anniversary and sitting on top of a pile of rubble in the Ukraine doing it. But, you know, particularly the West that hectors the rest of the world about this is susceptible because they're invoking people and they never seem to quite understand why the votes didn't go their way so unanimously on Ukraine when most UN members, and I've spoken to a lot of them, are saying, excuse me, how come it applies to Russia but not to Israel? How come it applies to our friends, but not to their friends? And these are valid questions. They're not valid in the sense that whataboutery is a terrible way. You know, you can't accuse me of murder. Did you see what that guy down the road did to his wife? It does not work. It does not work as a principle. But Craig, now you resigned over the lack of activity there. And it's quite clear there are huge inhibitions on United Nations staff and agencies about what they can and can't say. Could you explain why you resigned and what the background of this is in how the UN can deal with human rights in general and particularly in the Middle East?
Absolutely. First, Ian, thanks for doing this and for inviting me to participate in the conversation. So my conversation about leaving the UN after 32 years started in the late winter and early spring when there were a series of human rights atrocities that were taking place actually on the West Bank, including the infamous pogrom in the village of Hawara, a number of Israeli military attacks on civilians and so on. And at that time, given the seriousness of what was happening, I found myself quite frustrated with the cautious, often trepidatious approaches that the political side of the UN were taking in the face of these kinds of horrific atrocities. And so I was speaking out quite publicly, as I had on human rights abuses taking place in dozens of countries all around the world on all continents for 32 years and had never been silenced in doing so. But I knew that there had been a growing trend when it came to Israel of a tamping down with inside the organization out of a fear of the kind of pressure that inevitably comes from the United States, from the United Kingdom, from parts of Europe, and from these pro-Israel proxy organizations, lobby groups that had been set up over the course of the last couple of decades with the specific purpose of pressuring and attacking the UN whenever it dares to speak out on Israel. And this time it took hold, and I actually received a kind of gag order. I was told to stop my public pronouncements on the situation, only, by the way, only with regard to Israel. No one told me that I couldn't speak out on situations elsewhere in the world, but only with regard to Israel. And I obviously, for myself, was very uncomfortable in that because I grew up in the international human rights movement, starting with the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa more than 40 years ago, and then spent 32 years at the UN, largely unconstrained, I have to say, on these issues. And suddenly I was asked to be quiet. But even more than that, I felt that this trend, which was getting worse and worse, of overly cautious, trepidatious, unprincipled approaches on Israeli violations of Palestinian human rights was getting so bad that it was undercutting the legitimacy of the organization, including the human rights side of the house. And let me say this, Ian, my criticism of the UN then and now is a criticism of certain part of the UN. It's of the political side of the house. It's of the intergovernmental bodies. It's of the political leadership, which, as you know, are not a part of the engine of the UN, which is all of these professionals who are working on humanitarian relief and human rights and development and so on. These are people who are absolutely committed to eradicating poverty and war and abuses and inequalities and so on. But the leadership, the political leadership, who are political appointees who often come directly from governments with seats that are reserved for particular governments. The head of political affairs always comes from the State Department and the U.S. government. The head of humanitarian affairs always comes from the British, designated by the British government. The head of peacekeeping always from the French and so on. And that was very much compromising the normative role of the organization because the UN is, it's not supposed to be a conference center where there's no lowest common denominator. You know, that's the other side of 42nd Street. You can go to a large conference center, the Javits Center on the other side of Manhattan, which has, you know, no normative position. It's just conference rooms. The UN is supposed to be this constitutional organization that is based upon international law, international human rights, the language of the charter, the UN human rights treaties and so on. But this tug of war that's been going on for the length of the existence of the UN between those who think its mission is about the norms and standards that it articulates to be evenly applied to all countries on the one side. And on the other side, legions of UN officials, especially at the top, who always want to defer the normative mission of the organization on behalf of some vague notions of political expediency and deference, really, in deference to power.
Perhaps we should explain, because not every, I mean, you've absorbed it with your, not quite your mother's milk, but shortly afterwards, the idea of an independent international civil service when right. Working for the United Nations, staff are supposed to sign a document eschewing all allegiances to others. And yet in the last week or so, apropos of what we're talking about, Cindy McLean, the wife of a Republican candidate who was dumped on the UN by the current president, on the World Food Organization, decided to show up and give a prize to his Israeli government officer for the heroism of Israeli people while her staff were being shot and shelled and impeded on the border of Gaza, which caused a barrack room revolt in the World Food Organization, didn't it?
Absolutely, it did. And that's another clear example of the disconnect between people who are on the ground and who see the horrors that are being perpetrated and really believe in the mission as it is articulated and political leadership that's there for entirely other reasons. And that's very much the struggle in which I found myself engaged, not for the first time, but so severely that I decided that I would leave the organization. And I informed the High Commissioner for Human Rights at that time, and I communicated to him my wish that the organization would abandon these trepidatious, deferential approaches and get back to its original its original mission. And the point that you make, I mean, they turn this on its head, Ian, this idea of the international civil servant, because, you know, I was attacked for speaking out in this case. And the accusation by these lobby groups that were trying to get me fired within the organization were that I had violated my duties as an independent international civil servant because I wasn't being neutral. But there's nothing in the rules of the International Civil Service about being neutral. To the contrary, if you are a UN human rights official, your job is to take sides, take the side of the victim, as Camus said, you know, against those who are perpetrating gross violations of human rights. We have a duty of impartiality. So you can't take sides with one state over another. But it is our job, if we're serious about the human rights provisions of the organization, to defend those against against all perpetrators. So they kind of turn that on its head. And then the conclusion is you should be silent in the face of gross violations of human rights, even war crimes, crimes against humanity, ethnic cleansing, genocide. Don't say it. Now, there are parts of the UN that have been absolutely principled. And I give the most credit here to the independent UN human rights mechanisms that are not politically compromised and undeterred, done a great job. Special rapporteurs, commissions of inquiry, independent treaty bodies.
They'll come under very heavy pressure.
They come under a lot of pressure, even harassment. And yet they have been very, very principled. But it is that other side of the house. And let me say this as well. You know, there are 138 of my former UN colleagues who have been murdered under Israeli bombs just in the last several weeks inside Gaza, who were there with their families, by the way, who were there doing absolutely vital life-saving work, everything essential to normal human life in the Gaza Strip. And with those people, you can only be in absolute solidarity. So there's that side of the UN, and then there's the political side of the house, together with the Security Council, just as an example of an absolutely ineffectual Cold War relic. I'm sorry, Second World War relic of the victors of the Second World War, given this veto, which is always used to prevent protection of civilians. And of course, most infamously by the US repeatedly, I think 45 times, having used its veto to stop human rights protection in the occupied territories. So that side of the house deserves our strongest critique, not in a general, you know, dissing of the United Nations, but because we stand in solidarity with the people who are trying to do, you know, peace and human rights and development and humanitarian relief and so on. And they've been abandoned.
I was thinking of this yesterday when you probably saw the shots yourself, a whole lineup of IDF troops behind a parapet cheering enthusiastically when an UNRWA, a United Nations school, was blown up. It had been used as a shelter, and they cheered enthusiastically. And I don't know whether you know this, but Ban Ki-moon, one of Ban Ki-moon's proudest achievements, which he didn't boast about too much for obvious reasons, was he actually got the Israelis to pay compensation for when they shelled and destroyed a UN warehouse in Gaza. He got a check out of them. He was the one and only. They were trying to butter him up. But in general, of course, the countries that pay for this, usually the European Union or the US, just simply write another check to rebuild without mentioning it to the people who blew it up. Well, and it's that sense of impunity that gets really disgusting.
And this is another core problem with the approach of the political side of the house. I mean, yeah, Ban Ki-moon got them to pay for that damage, but he did it by commissioning what's called a board of inquiry. And a board of inquiry is a very specific mechanism invented on the 38th floor to avoid doing a commissioned inquiry. What's the difference? A commission of inquiry is an independent mechanism, usually supported by the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights, that's looking for accountability of perpetrators and redress for victims for war crimes, gross violations of human rights, and so on. A board of inquiry is a confidential, no accountability inquiry that doesn't, you know, these are war crimes we're talking about when you destroy UN facilities in this way, that doesn't look and won't be made public for accountability in that way, simply for compensation for physical damage that has been caused. And what happens whenever you have a situation like this, you've got to move by member states and civil society and the human rights mechanisms to have an independent commission of inquiry to look into it for purposes of accountability of perpetrators, redress for victims, trying to put an end to impunity, and then a push from the New York side of the house to have, no, we'll do a board of inquiry. It'll be all top secret. We'll get some, maybe some money out of it, but there'll be no accountability for perpetrators. And in a way, that just feeds impunity. It provides, and we should talk about fig leaves, it provides a fig leaf that allows the status quo to continue. And that, you know, that word status quo, the approach that says that we will operate on the basis of political expediency rather than our normative mandate always means deferring to power. And it always means deferring to the status quo. Let's try to paper over what's happened and move on with the status quo as it was before, which only leads to an exacerbation of human rights situations over time because the root causes are never addressed. Why? Because it doesn't take any courage to say, someday we're going to have a two-state solution. You can repeat those mantras over and over again, but to address root causes, to talk about persecution, settler colonialism, apartheid, gross and systematic violations of human rights, that takes a modicum of political courage that the political leadership in the UN would rather, or doesn't have, or would rather not spend on something as trivial as human rights. Let's just get everything calmed down again and proceed with the situation as it was. And that's why you end up with a smokescreen of the Oslo process, which for 30 years obscured what was really happening, which was continued dispossession, settlement activity, persecution, ethnic cleansing, horrific violations of human rights, thousands of prisoners being locked up and held without charge or trial. And then when you ask the UN about it, they say, well, the quartet's going to meet and we're going to work toward a two-state solution and let's all love each other and go home. How has that
worked? Well, you know, things are desperate when Netanyahu is suggesting bringing back Tony Blair to head sort of revived quartet in Gaza. This is worse than despair.
There's probably no one in the region who has less credibility than Tony Blair. And the idea that his name would even be mentioned except in jest with regard to something like that tells you just how unserious concerns about the so-called day after really are.
Well, the quartet has still got a shadowy half-life somewhere in the occupied territories, I believe. But I mean, I think those of us who saw it at the time saw it was a simple... Once again, it was an evasion. It was an attempt to borrow the prestige of the UN without giving it any power or responsibility. Mm-hmm. This comes back to the real issue here, which I think rather than pointing fingers, there's lots of fingers to point and lots of places to point at. But what can, we have this Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which unlike other international legislation, like for example, the International Law of the Sea, which is an intricately crafted piece of work, which has its own means of enforcement. That was never done with the Declaration of Human Rights for fairly obvious reasons, because everyone can point fingers. I mean, the Russians could point to segregation, they could point to apartheid. The Americans could point to the gulags and famines in China and Russia. So nobody really, there was a sort of a vow of silence between the great powers that they won't mention it to each other. But then we moved into the 70s and as it there began an era of naming and shaming being possible. So, you know, it was quite a step forward to say that Serbia was actually wrong and should be thrown out, that South Africa was committing apartheid and there should be sanctions, resisted furiously, we might add, by Russia, by America and Britain and France, who all found excuses for apartheid at the time, just as they do for other forms of apartheid now. But what can the UN effectively do? What type of pressure, you as a human rights official? Now, the naming and shaming struck me as the key, but you know, there's a point of, if you do name somebody too often, they're not going to listen. Mary Robinson thought if she could go and speak to the Chinese, she could stroke them into good behavior. And to some extent, it was true. They would try to keep in the good graces of the international organizations and not be too egregious. At least they wouldn't nuke Xinjiang, but they kept everything else up. What can you do? I mean, what type of measures? What is the UN not doing that it could do, I suppose?
I mean, first, it could stick to its norms and standards. You know, you're right to go back to the history, and the really sort of striking historic irony here is that 75 years ago, 1948, was the year that the Universal Declaration was adopted. It was the year that the Genocide Convention was adopted. And it was also the year that apartheid started in South Africa, and the year that the Nakba, the first genocidal ethnic cleansing of Palestine, happened in Palestine. So you had these sort of these two parallel things taking place, one an effort to kind of create a framework of international law with these norms and standards that were supposed to guide conduct everywhere. And as they were being issued, you had these horrific things happening in Palestine and South Africa. And it's very illustrative of why this sort of reverting to political expediency is not the right way to go when it comes to human beings being persecuted in some way. Because in South Africa, and by the way, you're right, everything that had teeth was adopted in the 1970s after the majority of formerly colonized states became member states of the UN. And so there's this mythology out here that human rights are a gift from the West that are imposed on the others, when in fact, all of the monitoring mechanisms, all of the naming and shaming devices, all of those things were actually developed after by a majority that brought these in because they knew what it was like to struggle against colonial domination, foreign occupation, all of the persecution to which they had been subjected. But you know, if you look at the case of South Africa versus the case in Palestine, you see how this works. You know, in South Africa, the UN remained focused once it got its act together. The UN remained focused on eliminating apartheid, on an agenda of human rights, equality, and international law in South Africa until the day that apartheid fell. In Palestine, because of political pressure from the US, from the UK, from Israel, and others, for this the so-called Oslo process, they completely abandoned that approach 30 years ago. And they replaced it with this amorphous political formula that sometime in the future suggested there would be a two-state solution of some kind, and that pushed into the background any assertions of international law and international human rights. It said, that is unhelpful for the peace process. We're going to defer to what the two parties can agree. Well, when you're deferring to what two parties can agree, and one of those parties is backed up by the US and the UK and much of Europe, and the other party is occupied and oppressed and disempowered. You know, people forget as well that the PLO laid down their weapons and recognized Israel at the beginning of the Oslo process. Not only did Israel not recognize Palestine or lay down its weapons, it continued military assaults on Palestinian communities for the entire lifespan of Oslo and expedited settlement activity, dispossession, persecution, all those sorts of things. And the UN contributed to that reality because it maintained this smokescreen behind which that deference to an uneven status quo led to an exacerbation of the situation on the ground and ultimately to more conflict. And today, I have argued to genocide itself. What we need in the UN is a return to the normative mission of the UN and an equal application of those standards as they were applied in South Africa to all other countries as well. And we should have an agenda where we're saying, we insist that the solution in the Middle East be equal rights for Christians, Muslims, and Jews, not a kind of exceptionalism where international and international human rights are viewed as unhelpful and pushed off into the background. It's true that when the Universal Declaration was adopted, it wasn't seen as a kind of binding document. It was a kind of cornerstone or something that would be built up afterwards. And indeed it was. That's where you got binding international legal treaties on civil and political rights, economic and social rights that have been ratified by the majority of countries in the world. Although there are some outliers like the US, which has a terrible ratification record. For example, it's the only country on the planet that has not ratified the Convention on the Rights of the Child. The main treaty protecting the human rights of children has been ratified by 193 countries. Only the US refuses to ratify it. It hasn't signed on to the framework in lots of other ways. But in general, these treaties have been adopted. Alongside them, international humanitarian law, the Geneva Conventions, the statute of the Rome of the International Criminal Court, the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court. I mean, these are all binding legal developments, which unfortunately, some of them have now been politically captured and rendered and neutered, really, by Western pressure so that you have an international criminal court that was supposed to be the great hope of individual criminal accountability, which is now viewed by much of the world as basically a politicized arm of the West that was set up to prosecute Africans, but never to touch, you know, the global North or the global West. And you see the great contradictions where the prosecutor of the court moved almost instantly to take action against Russia in Ukraine, but has been quite shamefully dragging its feet on cases brought to it of Israeli violations against Palestinians for years now, and no sign from Prosecutor Khan that he's going to make a break from this continues to show a very politicized, biased deference.
In your position in the human rights apparatus, did you have occasion to speak to Khan?
I have not met Khan himself. I mean, I was alongside all of my human rights colleagues pushing very hard for the establishment of the International Criminal Court. Right, and like many people, deeply, deeply disappointed in its failure. I think the International Criminal Court is on the verge of fading into obscurity as a failed experiment. And if they don't, if Khan doesn't step down or isn't removed, and the court doesn't restore its credibility by being a global, a universal mechanism that will hold all perpetrators account for the crimes in its statute. Remember, the Rome Statute is war crimes, crimes against humanity, genocide, and aggression. You know, in the current moment, they are really hanging by a thread. And if this situation doesn't reverse itself in a very dramatic way, that will be the end of all the efforts to build up the international. And I think that would be a shame. I think we should be building up the ICC, not tearing it down. But if it's going to tear itself down, there's nothing we can do to help it, right? And so this is, and I just want to say one more thing, Ian. You mentioned this idea of behind the scenes conversation. Human rights diplomacy is very important. Not everything is a press release, you know, critiquing a country and naming and shaming and so on. There is a lot of work that goes beyond, you know, below the tip of the iceberg is mostly human rights diplomacy, discreet engagement with countries, including perpetrators of horrific violations, to try to get an objective, to try to get something delivered that will improve the situation for an individual or a group in a particular country. And that's absolutely essential. Sometimes UN actors are criticized for that, but it really is important. But not if in the process you're abandoning your obligation to the victims as defined in international human rights law. And there has to be a point at which, you know, you realize that you're just being used again as a fig leaf for a country that's committing violations. And you have to know when to draw the line to go public. And countries invest massive amounts of diplomatic and economic resources trying to avoid critique by these UN mechanisms, because they know it affects their standing in international organizations, in the international community, it affects trade, it affects investment. So they do push back. It's not like it's totally soft, but there is no enforcement outside of the Security Council and judicial mechanisms like the ICC, like the ICJ, and for these kinds of crimes in any court in the world, because these are crimes of universal jurisdiction.
There is, I suppose it's an oblique compliment to the apparatus that countries like Iraq in the old days and Iran and Syria were always so sedulously trying to get on these bodies and shape them, even if they disagreed with everything that they stood for. And, that's slightly less, there is a little more flexibility in the elections, the less rigidly Buggins turn than they used to be. But the fact that Israel got onto some of these committees because of US pressure and European pressure now is still sort of interesting because it's regarded as unfair. When we pull these things together, there are some fine compromises between pragmatism and principle. And one that's looming up, I remember during the Balkan Wars, and I would not envy being one of the UN figures on the ground, faced with the option of facilitating the evacuation of civilians from an area where the Serbs were very, very likely to massacre them, and being accused of participating in ethnic cleansing. What do you do? Because this is essentially something that's looming about as Israel is pushing for people to take Palestinian refugees from Gaza. They must be offered a home. No one says they should be offered their old homes back in behind the 67 lines. Not enough people are pointing that out when it is offered to them. But I mean, at some point, the UN officials on the ground are likely to be presented with this real devil's dilemma. Do they leave them to be massacred and bombed and starved, or do they help evacuate them and thereby facilitate what the Israelis are trying to achieve? I mean, this is the question of the ages almost. Your thoughts about the parameters of the problem?
I mean, there are two huge issues there. One of them is, you know, the sort of affirmative obligation of UN actors in the face of mass atrocities. And the UN has repeatedly failed in the face of mass atrocities, not just in Bosnia-Herzegovina, not just in Rwanda, not just in Myanmar, but, you know, it's a long catalog, and repeatedly, obviously, in the occupied territories. And every time there's a massive failure like this, there's a kind of a soul-searching exercise convened within the UN to see how we did it wrong, how it can be improved. There are always these initiatives that are that become landmark initiatives of each successive Secretary General on how they're going to fix it. And I think that this, I mean, you say that there's a struggle between pragmatism and principle. Of course, there always is. One has to be pragmatic as one is being principled. But more often than not, what happens is people view that as a binary in the UN, and they abandon all principle because they say that is the politically expedient or the realistic thing to do. Or, you know, they think that the answer is simply to stand on a soapbox and denounce a particular actor. Neither one of those is going to take place, but almost inevitably, what happens is a kind of abdication because, you know, we have to be realistic. You know, and then the second thing, of course, is the current situation in Gaza, and the risk that some international actor might be complicit in the ethnic cleansing of Gaza, which, in my view, is very clearly and has been from the first day. The intention of the government of Israel is to ethnically purge Gaza, to start at the north, to destroy everything as you move down that makes a civilian life in Gaza impossible. Destroy as much as you can, and before some pressure comes along from the U.S. or elsewhere to stop you. And then to make sure that Gaza is not rebuilt, that any survivors are sort of left in a hellscape in the south of Gaza to either, you know, live and die in horrific conditions or to flee through the Rafah border and disappear in tents inside the Sinai or into the diaspora. And that if anyone were to ratify that or participate in it, whether it's the government of Egypt or some Gulf state that offers to finance it, or the U.S. that supports it behind the scenes, or any U.N. actor were to participate in it, they would literally be participating in ethnic cleansing. And that, from a normative perspective, cannot be tolerated. It's also a false dilemma, because you have another choice, which is massive aid and reconstruction in Gaza to restore a decent life for these brutalized Palestinian civilians. What's happening now is they're trying to create a perception that the only opportunity is for people to be physically purged. I don't think we can stand with that. But on the general point applicable globally, it reminds me of Kofi Annan, who you knew well, who was the Undersecretary General for Peacekeeping, both during the Rwanda genocide and during what happened in Srebrenica. And in, you know, later when he was Secretary General, he was very haunted by the UN's failures and by its inaction in the face of these massive threats to the civilian populations there. And you'll remember Ed Mortimer, who was a brilliant speechwriter and senior advisor and somebody, you know, I respected a great deal when he was on the 38th floor. And he called me up and he said, you know, Craig, the Secretary General wants to go to the Stockholm Forum, which is this very visible venue where he would make a speech. And he wants to apologize for the UN's failures in those circumstances. But two, he doesn't just want to apologize. He wants to say that we're going to do something different to prevent this from happening again. So we came back to him and made a proposal that we had known that you had the human rights system in Geneva, the political system in New York. There was a brick wall between them. The UN human rights system had predicted the genocide in Rwanda and had made a number of recommendations on how to stop that from happening. There was a special rapporteur called Bakwalian Diaye, Senegalese human rights expert who had just done a mission there and had warned about this. utterly ignored in New York, couldn't get a hearing in the Security Council, and nobody on the 38th floor would ever read such a report in those days. So the proposal we made is, let's establish an independent special rapporteur on the prevention of genocide, would be independent, would be supported by the Human Rights Office in Geneva, and would be given opportunities to report directly to the Security Council. Kofi Annan goes to Stockholm, makes this landmark speech, and he says it exactly as we proposed it. I intend to establish an independent special rapporteur on the prevention of Palestine, supported by the Human Rights Office, reporting directly to the Security Council to ring the bell when there is a threat of genocide emerging in a particular setting. He said it. There was a huge fanfare for him having done that as something very, very significant in closing the gap between the human rights side and the political side. And then the political side, the Department of Political Affairs, got a hold of it. And they said, oh, no, 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 we can't do this. It can't be independent. It has to be a part of the Secretariat so we control it. It can't be supported by the Human Rights Office because we need it to be supported by the Political Affairs Department so we can control the content of what it's likely to say. And it can't report to the Security Council. It can only report to the Secretary General because we don't know what the impact would be on members of the Security Council. And they completely neutered the proposal. And we ended up with an Office on the Prevention of Genocide, which is an entirely politicized, weak, orphaned, and now completely irrelevant office that once again has failed to address emerging genocide in the occupied territories because it was set up to fail out of fear, out of trepidation, out of a deference to what was thought to be a pragmatic focus on political expediency rather than this pie in the sky, normative, independent kind of thing that those human rights people want to do. The system has failed again because the basic impulses of the organization have not changed in spite of the fact that we're several secretary generals later and making the same kinds of mistakes.
We have, you mentioned a key word there. You mentioned genocide. I was about to bring up the concept of ecocide. When the Romans conquered Carthage, they plowed salt into the ruins. At the moment, it looks like the IDF is about to pour salt water into the subsoil of Gaza because they're threatening to flood the tunnels. And this is an area where I happen to know, I've known for years, the watershed has been increasingly under salinification because of Israeli pumping on the actual border. They're pumping so much fresh water out, it's drawing in salt water already. So the aquifer is almost unsustainable. So this should finish it off. I don't think it's got the attention that it deserves. This is a form of ecocide. But to get back to the genocide, Frank Gomez has just asked the question about the usefulness of the concept of genocide and whether it's taking place. I did write a piece for The Guardian some years ago in which I said, you know, genocide is a horrifying concept, but it's not useful as a tool because mass murder is awful. Once you start introducing the idea of that there are gradations of this and the genocide is worse, you start getting the wiggle room in. Like the Khmer Rouge didn't commit genocide because it was Khmer on Khmer. The Kulaks were Ukrainian, so that wasn't genocide. And you go through legalistic rambling when the mere fact mass murder by governments is wrong. You know, that covers everything as far as I'm concerned, including ethnic dispossession and so on. So is genocide a useful concept? It was in the sense when Ralph Lemkin introduced it, it was intended like the Apartheid Convention as a trigger for international action to prevent it. At the moment, it seems more like an obfuscation to avoid it because people are arguing about whether it's genocide or not instead of saying, no, what you're doing is wrong, it's mass murder, and we're going to stop you.
Yeah, and I think Frank's question is the question of the day because the answer as to whether or not you know, there's even going to be a concept of genocide in the coming years is being determined as we speak. Now, genocide has been important enough to the international community that it has been codified in the relatively newest instrument, which is the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court, you know, all these years after the adoption of the Genocide Convention. And there's no doubt that genocide is probably one of the most, the only thing that's probably more politicized than the term of genocide is the term terrorism, right? Terrorism is what the other guy does. genocide is what our enemies do, and democracy, right? We're a democracy and they're not. I mean, these have become meaningless terms, but genocide is defined in international law. And it's defined with great clarity in the Genocide Convention, setting out not just the acts that constitute genocide, but the specific intention that needs to accompany those acts, right? So, you know, acts like killings and causing serious harm, deliberately inflicting conditions of life on a population calculated to bring about its destruction and so on. And then all of that with this very specific intention to destroy in whole or in part a national, ethnical, racial, or religious group as such, right? So it is, because it's politicized, it's often asserted in cases where it's not happening, where there are awful things happening, but it's not genocide. And it's often denied in cases where it clearly was. I have said that's what's happening here. That I have said that I have never seen in all my years in the international human rights movement a case that so clearly mirrors the exact language of the Genocide Convention. And that if this is not treated as a genocide, the very concept of genocide is at risk, and it won't be there to revert to when we see these kinds of atrocities happening in the future. Now, you're absolutely right that, you know, even if someone ignores the crime of genocide, you still have all the evidence of massive war crimes, crimes against humanity, gross violations of human rights. These things are all happening. And it's not like there's a hierarchy. There is in the minds of people a hierarchy of these crimes, crimes against humanity, genocide. But it is important because it is a crime under international law and it's not being enforced. I mean, just think about it. 18,000 Palestinians in a cage, locked in a cage, exterminated in just a matter of a few weeks, 8,000 of them children, for example, about 50,000 injured, many thousands more still under the rubble, dying slow, excruciating deaths, many more dying slow deaths because of disease, many more now suffering from starvation in the Gaza Strip on the Mediterranean Sea, this horrifying wholesale slaughter of a civilian population with, you know, whole neighborhoods razed to the ground, massive ordnance dropped on densely populated civilian areas, homes, refugee camps, schools, clinics, humanitarian facilities, you know, I mean, whole multi-generational families erased from the public register altogether in their hundreds. And of course, serious harm went up to, that's very obvious, but there's this provision in the refugee, in the Genocide Convention that, you know, is often a complex one, but is so clear here, which is this idea of deliberately inflicting conditions on a group that are calculated to bring about its destruction in whole or in part. And here you have 2.3 million civilians in Gaza, you know, poor, food insecure, already refugees, most of them children, right? They're locked into a cage, doesn't exist anywhere else on the planet. There's a siege imposed by Israel on them since at least 2005 with the closure and then progressively worse and worse in a siege, restricting food, water, sanitation, medicine, construction, free movement, all elements of a decent life, and then periodically launching military attacks against this caged civilian population. And then since October, a total siege, cutting off all food, water, and other essentials from them. And then launching the attacks, you know, more than 2 million women, children, men forcibly displaced, destroying all of the civilian infrastructure. So there has never been a case which so closely mirrors this Article 2C of the Genocide Convention. If it's not said to apply here, it doesn't exist. But this is the last thing on this, Ian. I mean, genocide scholars from all around the world, human rights monitors, Holocaust scholars and others have all been saying the same thing, which is they've never seen a clear case of openly declared genocidal intent ever.
Openly declared, that's the point. The Israeli politicians are explicit about what they're trying to do.
In usual cases, what happens is after the dust settles, you go and you dig through government archives looking for evidence of communications between government officials proving that it was genocide. But here, and by the way, the International Court of Justice, the World Court, says because it's hard to prove intent, you can infer intent from conduct, right? So in this case, 75 years of ethnic purges that started in Nakba and have continued in the West Bank and elsewhere is already evidence that what they're doing in Gaza is intended to be another ethnic purge. But because the climate of impunity with regard to the Israeli government has been so absolute, thanks to the US and the UK and parts of Europe, they're openly declaring this, right? That's rarely the case. I mean, you've got the president, the prime minister, cabinet officials, senior military officials, openly dehumanizing Palestinians as cockroaches, a subhuman, terrorists, cancer, ants, vermin, all of these kinds of things, and then declaring an intent to the public, an intent to wipe out all of Gaza, not to distinguish between civilians and combatants, razing Gaza to the ground, the need to reduce it to rubble, to bury them alive, and explicitly to carry out another Nakba. And of course, everybody has heard the blood-curdling call of Prime Minister Netanyahu invoking the biblical verse about Amalek that commands that the entire population be wiped out, that none be spared, including women, children, and suckling babies, as well as their livestock.
And yes, the livestock.
The livestock.
It might get more sympathy from many Americans and British. They're going to kill the cats and dogs as well.
That's sadly true, because Palestinians have been so thoroughly dehumanized in the West in particular that, you know, there's an open question out there. How many Palestinians do you have to kill before it registers morally in the consciousness of the West, versus how many Ukrainians you have to kill or how many Israelis you have to kill, and so on? I mean, this is very clearly a feature of why this impunity has continued. So, and then you're just the last point on this one is, so you've got the acts, you've got the intent, and then you also have, which is necessary in genocide analysis, you have to have the capacity to actually carry out a genocide, because people could say all sorts of awful things, but have no capacity to carry out a genocide. Well, here, you know, Israel has constructed this powerful apparatus of repression over a period of decades, which exists all across Palestine and Israel, including, you know, military occupation and assault forces, abusive police contingents, these ruthless intelligence agencies, physical things like walls and fences and barbed wire, autonomous weapons, you know, these little robots with machine guns on them, you know, the most advanced monitoring and surveillance technologies in the world, a whole system of repressive laws targeted at Palestine. So they absolutely have the means to carry out that genocide as well. So the conclusion to that is, if you have a case that is so clearly, as I have said, and before me, the Israeli genocide scholar Raz Sigal has said, a textbook case of genocide, just an absolute clear case of genocide, and you have people in the UN refusing to use the term, and a lack of adequate legal action to hold perpetrators to account, and a lack of preventive action, because the Genocide Convention imposes an obligation of prevention on everybody, then genocide no longer has any meaning, and it will disappear from the international law books, which is a loss first for the innocent Palestinian civilians who have been slaughtered, but for the rest of the world, who will no longer have recourse to this particular protection in international law. And that is something very striking, literally, on the 75th anniversary of the Genocide Convention, on the eve of which, by the way, one day before the annual Day Against Genocide and the anniversary of the convention, the U.S. Ambassador in New York, you know, in that infamous photo, raised his hand to block a ceasefire, after which many, many, many more people have been killed in what I have called a case of genocide. So we all have a lot to lose here, and it's a frightening moment in history from my perspective.
Well, we come back to our responsibilities. We are the Foreign Press Association, and there's particular sort of incumbencies upon the media The people who are doing this tend to bedazzle the media and talk about unfairness. That's the language always used in Israel. It's unfair to single out Israel. And I say, well, my answer to that has always been, well, if Israel doesn't want to be singled out, Israel should stop doing it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And people will stop pointing fingers. But there are, you know, there's a broader issue here of how it's treated and how the media go about it. And, you know, there's a war of attrition against the whole idea of human rights violations by Israel. I mean, it is, it's almost like a Pavlovian treatment. Any reporter in America and in Britain now, which wasn't quite the case, wasn't as bad a case when I left many years ago, will be pilloried right away for suggesting that Israel commits these crimes, because it's sort of axiomatic that Israel can't do this. And only somebody who's thoroughly biased would actually make such allegations.
Yeah.
So it's increasingly difficult. It's been very pleasant to see, not pleasant, but heartening to see on the streets so many people who are seeing through it and appalled by what's being done in their name by the IDF and the US diplomats. Mm-hmm. But you know, what can journalists do in the face of proprietorial and governmental interference to uphold human rights in a neutral way? Nobody asked them to love Hamas. Nobody asked them to love Arabs. But at least you can distinguish between why is it that an Israeli who goes in and shoots up a house is a soldier and a Hamas guy who's shooting from the house is a terrorist. Axiomatic. You never see that used in any other context. That when Israelis are killed by Hamas, they are massacred, whereas the completely neutral, value-free when Palestinian casualties.
Palestinians die.
Yes.
They're not brutally murdered or...
That's a little active. Palestinians are killed. Palestinians suffer. There are Palestinian casualties.
Right. Yeah, and this is really in such an important issue right now because, frankly, at least I'm living in the United States now, and what I'm seeing is Western, especially U.S. media, dropping the ball in horrendous ways. Just as an example, if you ask what they can do, one is don't participate in the dehumanization of the civilian population that's being attacked, number one, because there's a lot of just parroting of dehumanizing narratives about Palestinians in Gaza that I hear every day in the media here in the West. Two, don't just disseminate non-critically propaganda being given to you by Israel and its proxies, even when that information is coming from already discredited sources for fabrications that have been disproven, and then you still continue to take that information and to parrot it on. There are still people reporting about 40 beheaded babies that...
President of the United States is one such, so it's not...
The United States is one. And by the way, let me say of the United States and the United Kingdom and some European countries, the obligations with regard to genocide and the obligations with regard to war crimes... they impose affirmative action on the part of countries like the U.S., one, to ensure respect for the Geneva Conventions vis-a-vis those other parties they have influence over, in this case, very clearly, Israel, and to act to prevent genocide. So that's one level of obligation. But what has happened is that you have the U.S. and the U.K. and others who have gone beyond a breach of those, and they're actively complicit. Because if while these crimes are taking place, you continue to provide weapons and economic support and intelligence support and diplomatic support and the use of the veto, thereby facilitating further and using your podium of the State Department, National Security Council, the Pentagon, the White House and others to parrot non-critically false propaganda delivered to them from Israeli sources, you are actually committing a crime in international law known as complicity. And then, we should remember as well, and I am the closest thing to a free speech absolutist you will ever meet, because I know those who suffer from restrictions on speech are always the weak ones, the minorities, the human rights defenders. But there are provisions in international law about incitement for things like genocide. And there have been both in the Nuremberg Tribunal and in the Rwanda Tribunal, media personnel held accountable for incitement to genocide because of what they were publishing as these genocides were unfolding. And frankly, I see some of that in the media that I've been watching. So first of all, is be a journalist. If you are just a stenographer for Israeli propaganda, I don't see why you're collecting a paycheck from something that claims to be a media, that claims to be a media outlet, but there's so much of that. And that's before you get to the issues that you raised, the subtle bias of the fact that Palestinians die and And you know, Israelis are brutally slaughtered in all of these cases. And frankly, you know, the UN itself is guilty of this. You know, if you listen to speeches in the Security Council from senior UN officials, you will hear not a single criticism of Israeli abuses, not a hint about accountability. You will get the idea that the killings happening in the Gaza Strip are just technical violations of humanitarian law. But what Hamas did was brutal and slaughter and so on. You know, that even comes from UN officials, which is to say, some lives are more important than other lives. And if that's coming out of the UN, how do we expect journalists to be doing their job? Journalists need to learn, what are the rules? What are the rules?
Well, that brings us a beautiful segue. I'm sorry, Jordan, we're going to have time for your question, relevant though it is. We will, in the new year, we're intending with the FPA, and I hope we'll get you, Craig, and others, to actually discuss what the role of journalism is in promoting human rights. And this is difficult, because in the Columbia J School, it's amazing when you talk to people, we don't promote human rights. They really think that this is a partisan issue, and it isn't, because as a, was how many 120 dead journalists in Gaza and the West Bank and Lebanon demonstrate, it is not a partisan issue. It's a matter of survival for accurate and working journalists. So we're hoping to hold a panel in the new year with other partners, and we'd really welcome any suggestions for journalism students and others to go over the type of issues that Craig's have been talking about on, you know, what is a war crime? How does it, how do we report them? How do we promote human rights and not accept the full spoonful of bile that comes out of the government hands? Normal journalistic standards, skepticism and asking the relevant questions should do it, but obviously these fall by the wayside over the years. So on behalf of the forum, I invite you to send me any suggestions you have for speakers, topics and details, because obviously it's fairly essential work. And in the meantime, since we're coming up to the season of goodwill between Hanukkah and Christmas and Kwanzaa and whatever, and New Year. So I'd like to wish you all, I hate happy holidays, but Merry Christmas, cheerful Hanukkah, carefree Kwanzaa, and hope to see you all soon in one way or another. Thank you very much, Craig. I think it was an interesting and probing discussion, and we hope to see you in the new year when we go into this in more detail in an exploratory way with members and others. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you, Ian. Thanks to everybody.